At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing absolute return funds for all kinds of investors. Details at Putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
7,465. That is today's closing mark for the Dow Industrials. Haven't been here in more than 6 years, October 9th, 02. By some measures, that makes sense. By others, it actually doesn't. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Palm Wonderful, 100% pomegranate juice in the curvy bottle, the antioxidant superpower. Information at pomwonderful.com. Sustainability reporting is supported by Johnson Controls, making homes, cars, and workplaces more comfortable, safe, and sustainable. Johnson Controls, where ingenuity is welcome.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Thursday, the 19th of February. Economists had a lot of new numbers to chew on today. Some of them left a bitter aftertaste. The number of folks filing for unemployment benefits has hit a record high. Others seemed kind of sweet. An index used to forecast where the economy is heading rose last month. So how do you reconcile all that? Here's Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer.
Talk about doing the numbers. Today we got figures on unemployment claims, producer prices, and the Conference Board's index of leading economic indicators. Add them up and we should get a nice, clear economic picture, right? Not necessarily. The Leading Economic Indicators Index tries to forecast economic activity. It was up unexpectedly in January by 0.4%. But Credit Suisse economist Jonathan Basile says the index was skewed by the Fed pumping money into the economy.
When you look within the bowels of this leading index, it's still unclear if this is a true bounce or if this is more just a reflection of the massive liquidity injections.
The index saw all that liquidity and said, Eureka, lots of cash is sloshing around. But actually, the money isn't circulating. Banks are holding on to most of it. The producer price index numbers released today are also skewed by higher energy prices. That leaves us with the unemployment numbers. Unfortunately, they don't lie. The ranks of U.S. workers on unemployment surged 170,000, a record high.
The labor market is fairly weak, continues to be weak, and will probably continue to be weak for the foreseeable future.
That prediction was easy for Oscar Gonzalez, an economist at John Hancock. The tricky part is putting all of today's numbers together and making sense of them. Economist Carrie Leahy of Decision Economics takes a stab at it.
Not everything is bad, so I would think the economy is going to bottom in 6 months. So the economy won't be doing well, but it will not be falling 6 months from now.
Let's hope he's right. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
You know things are bad on Wall Street when the guy picked to police it has a history of chasing down terrorists. Robert Kuzami was named the new enforcement chief of the Securities and Exchange Commission today. He's a former New York federal prosecutor who's gone after white-collar criminals as well as evildoers. One hopes he might first head off in hot pursuit of the nation's alleged Ponzi schemers. First, the SEC failed to catch on to Bernie Madoff, and now Alan Stanford. Stanford is suspected of what authorities are calling a massive fraud at his Caribbean-based banking group. Today, the FBI found him in Virginia. So, for not the first time, you have to wonder what it takes to get the SEC's attention. Ronnie Radbill reports from Washington.
To find out how bad an offense has to be, I thought who better to ask than the man who used to run the SEC, former Chairman Harvey Pitt.
It's not a question of how bad it has to be. It's what kinds of evidence they are capable of finding.
And that evidence doesn't come easy. He says the agency gets tips from public informants and does its own research. But insiders say the agency is chronically understaffed and underfunded. Kathleen Hamm is a former assistant director at the SEC's Enforcement Division.
It's very manually intensive and takes a lot of effort, especially if someone is intent on deceiving not only investors, but the SEC and their investigators.
Fewer than 4,000 people work at the SEC, a tiny police force to patrol a financial system as large and complex as America's. Hal Scott's a professor at Harvard Law School. He says it doesn't help that many of the people at the SEC don't fully understand the markets they're required to police.
The SEC has traditionally been an agency of lawyers. And unfortunately for our profession, lawyers aren't always the most financially literate people.
Scott says that lack of knowledge means the SEC is ill-equipped to identify possible Ponzi schemes even when the red flags show up. He says, and Kathryn Hamm agrees, the SEC would be a lot better at chasing down fraudsters if it had a lot more money and more and better resources. In Washington, I'm Ronnie Radbill for Marketplace.
Looks like California will avoid a plummet off the high cliffs of the state's central coastline. As today dawned, the legislature approved a new budget. Months of bickering finally came to an end, with the state narrowly averting bankruptcy because of a $42 billion deficit. The plan includes some $12 billion in tax hikes, plus cuts to all kinds of state programs. And what about all those delayed tax refunds? Comptroller John Chung says there's no word on when the state's money machine might start cranking again.
The real test is when the actual cash comes in. At the end of the day, you can't pay bills when you don't have the cash in the state treasury.
But don't try to use that excuse when your bills are due. Meanwhile, in New York City, the mayor has announced a plan to use millions in government money to retrain Wall Street workers who've lost their jobs to the financial crisis. In 2007, there were around 350,000 people working in the banking and investment industry. The city believes by the end of this year that number will be down about 18%. Ashley Millen-Tite has more on Mayor Michael Bloomberg's resurrection plan.
Worst case scenario, 65,000 financial workers will be jobless by the end of this year.
We're going to turn those lemons into lemonade.
Seth Pinsky is president of the New York City Economic Development Corporation.
And we're going to figure out a way to get those people to create new diversified sectors of the city's economy.
Pinsky's talking about Mayor Bloomberg's $45 million plan to keep New York's financial talent at home. The mayor wants to attract international financial services startups to the city and even develop a venture capital industry here. But Bettina Damiani, director of Good Jobs New York, says these Wall Streeters don't need City Hall's help.
The biggest concern that we have is the amount of resources and political capital that the mayoral administration is willing to put into an industry that has the ability to train itself.
She says unlike other kinds of workers, traders and bankers have the money and education to work out their next moves on their own. Seth Pinsky says it's not about helping individuals.
Our goal at the end of the day, and we're pretty confident that we're going to achieve this goal, is not to create a bunch of one-person companies. It's to create companies that grow into the next generation of Google, the next generation of Facebook, the next Bloomberg.
Well, maybe. The mayor started his company with a $10 million severance package from Salomon Brothers in 1981. This generation of budding entrepreneurs probably won't get that lucky. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, we mentioned the Dow sank below the lowest point of last fall's financial earthquake. Details when we do the numbers. Before they can get more bailout money from the federal government, banks are going to have to go through what Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner is calling a stress test. They'll have to open up their books to regulators who will evaluate what kind of shape they're in. But dozens of bank regulators are always stationed full-time inside the country's biggest banks. So if they didn't catch the problems before, how are they going to do it this time? And how much might that effort cost? Here's Marketplace's Steve Henn.
The health of the nation's banks shouldn't be difficult to diagnose. Every 3 months, bank executives file federal reports that list a bank's capital, its assets, and which loans are past due or likely to default. But there's a hitch. Most banking experts, like Bert Ely, don't believe these reports are reliable.
The numbers are not bogus, but in a troubled bank situation, you have to discount them heavily.
In the last 2 years, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation has taken over 38 banks. And after the takeovers, Ely says the FDIC discovered these banks overstated the value of their assets on federal reports by more than $20 billion. John Hawks, the former comptroller of the currency. In the 90s, he was one of the top bank regulators in the country. And he says if regulators don't question the true value of assets listed on these reports, they can end up in big trouble.
Unless they know what the real value of a bank's capital is, they're essentially living in a fool's paradise where they believe that the stated values on a bank's books represent the real values.
And Hawk says accounting rules let bank managers paper over their problems. They can book the value of loans differently depending on what they say they plan to do with them. So if a bank says it intends to sell its loans, it has to value those loans at market prices. In some cases, that could be half the loan's original value. But if a bank says it's going to hold the same loan to maturity, it can book that loan at 100% of its value, even if it's obviously failing. And that's the trouble, according to Ely.
Banks and thrifts fill these reports out. They file them with the regulator. They get released very quickly online. And you essentially have to take the institution's word that it's correct.
But unlike Ely, bank regulators don't have to take anyone's word for it. Legally, they can dig deep into a bank's books. But Bill Black, a former banking regulator and whistleblower, says staff cuts over the past decade have meant fewer fines and less rigorous bank exams.
The cuts were very substantial, and they're worse than the numbers would indicate.
Black says the most experienced bank examiners were pushed out, even as the FBI announced the nation was facing an epidemic of mortgage fraud. Today, the FDIC is going on a hiring binge, but not for bank examiners, says Black. They're hiring experts in bank liquidation instead. And Black believes right now, no one in Washington knows how big the problems really are in the nation's more than 8,000 commercial banks.
The Secretary of the Treasury is saying it's going to be over $1 trillion, more likely in the range of $2 trillion to fix the bad asset problem.
But on the reports, every federally regulated bank in America claims it has assets that are worth more than its debts.
So there's a $2 trillion gap.
And Black says if bank regulators do real stress tests to figure out what will happen to banks' books if the economy continues to collapse, they'll see that $2 trillion gap get even bigger. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
That figure Steve just mentioned, $2 trillion. You know, I remember back in the day when $1 million seemed like a lot of money. Now it seems like every day we're talking billions, the stimulus package, the bank bailout. Add it all up and you've got those trillions. Commentator Casey Cole wonders how we're supposed to wrap our minds around such a ginormous number.
The fact is, you can't, because your brain is constructed something like a chessboard. There's an oft-told tale about the fellow who invented chess, so delighting his ruler that he got to choose his own prize. He asked that one piece of grain be placed on the first square of the chessboard, two on the next, four on the next, and so forth, doubling the number of grains for each square, right on up to 64. The resulting prize added up to more wheat than could be produced if every arable acre of land on earth were dedicated to it. Why is that so hard to see coming? Because our brains count the squares, not the grains. In a sense, our brains count only the logarithms of large numbers, the power they are raised to, rather than the number itself. 2 to the 6th power is only 64, but 2 to the 10th power is already more than 1,000. If you only count the difference between the powers, 6 and 10, you'll be badly misled. It's the same with millions, billions, and trillions. We automatically read a billion as about a third of a trillion. After all, it's only 3 zeros off. But of course, a trillion is 1,000 times a billion, and 1,000 is a lot. Decrease your salary by a factor of 1,000, and it could go from $200,000 to $200,000. Increase class size by the same amount, and your 15 students would turn into 15,000. That's roughly what happens when the M in million becomes a B. Our brains haven't evolved to directly deal with such staggering numbers, but we can use stories and metaphors to retrain ourselves. So the next time a trillion begins to sound like a billion, think about how you'd fare on a $200 annual salary, or survive teaching a class of 15,000 students instead of 15, in the same classroom, with the same number of books.
Casey Cole is a professor at the Annenberg School at USC. Her latest book is The Universe and the Teacup, The Mathematics of Truth and Beauty. The job search is tough on soldiers back from Iraq and Afghanistan, but there is some help out there.
They're out serving our country and putting their life on the line for us, and we can't give them a job. It really bothered me.
But first, let's do the numbers. Let's say you bought a basket of all the stocks that make up the Dow Industrials back in October of 2002. Today, you'd be right back where you started. The blue chip index sank to its lowest point in 6 years as it lopped off another 89 points, almost 1.2% to finish at 7,465. The NASDAQ fared worse, dropping 25 points, 1.7%, closing at 1,442. The S&P 500 declined 9 points, 1.2%, wrapping up the trading day at 778. Oil prices jumped on surprise news that we may be starting to burn more gasoline and oil inventories are shrinking. A barrel of crude rose to roughly $40. Some energy stocks went along for the ride. Chevron pumped up 0.8%. ExxonMobil picked up 0.3%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, helping more than 250,000 small businesses and nonprofits succeed using email marketing. ConstantContact.com. Constant Contact, a smart way to reach your customers. Coverage of Asia is supported by the Freeman Foundation. Keep an eye on Marketplace wherever you go. iPhone users can listen to business news and updates on fallout from the financial crisis, watch the Marketplace whiteboards, and follow the Scratchpad blog. Just visit marketplace.org on your iPhone.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases the Consumer Price Index for January. Mayors from across the country convene at the White House for a meeting with President Obama and Vice President Biden. And the United Nations observes the first annual World Day of Social Justice. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. There are a couple of ways that businesses and individuals can go when deciding how to deal with fallout from this financial crisis. Hunker down, do whatever's necessary to slash costs, or see this as a time to hunt for bargains and change the way business is done. Donald Sull says more of us should be contemplating the latter option. He's a professor of management at the London School of Business and also writes for the Harvard Business Review. His article this month is titled, How to Thrive in Turbulent Markets. Professor Sull, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
You know, every day we get news of layoffs, companies that are making all kinds of cuts throughout to trim costs. Is there a risk of cutting too much during this recession?
For sure there's a risk, Tess, of cutting too much. I think the more profound risk is missing the opportunities that are buried in this downturn. You know, in the midst of a downturn, very easy, as you say, to focus on the negative, the layoffs, the falling demand. But that negative focus obscures a fundamental truth, which is this. The worst of times for the economy as a whole can be the best of times for individual firms to create value.
You talk in the article about golden opportunities. What are, you know, kind of maybe the top three things that companies can really take a look at in terms of taking advantage of a downturn?
Obviously, your competitors are in pain. So your competitors are going to be pulling back and leaving opportunities on the table. So if you look at Adobe right now, they're being forced to pull back from web design software, creating a great opening for Microsoft. The second thing is you're often seeing distressed sellers. So if you look at Oracle, they're on a buying spree right now because a lot of these very interesting startups can't get cash from venture capitalists, can't even get cash from customers. The third thing is your customers are in pain too. And if you can offer products or services that allow them to cut their costs and retain their profitability, that can be a great opportunity.
What makes it so difficult to take advantage of this as an opportunity versus, I think you talk about, you know, a lot of companies really focus on managing the threats inherent in a downturn. Why do managers overreact in this situation?
You know, a lot of managers in companies are what I call one-pedal drivers. So in a boom, it's pedal to the metal, you know, full speed ahead, pursuing every opportunity in sight. And then comes a downturn, and boom, they slam on the brakes and give their organization a whiplash. So I think one of the things that makes it difficult is managers aren't accustomed oftentimes to tapping on the brake and the gas at the same time, looking for opportunities in a downturn, but also when times are flush, keeping control on costs.
You gave us the driving analogy, but there's also an article that you wrote for the Harvard Business Review where you compared business management in a recession to a boxing match.
Right.
Why boxing?
Oh, I was an avid and very bad boxer as a young man through university. So since I can't really do it well, I like to write about it.
I think that's the case for most of us writers, right?
Yeah, absolutely. If I could box professionally, I wouldn't be writing these articles. But I do find the metaphor is a helpful one to understand the following. In the downturn that we're in right now, organizations have two broad categories of ways that they can respond. So one is agility. You know, think Muhammad Ali in the Rumble in the Jungle, bobbing and weaving, where you can spot opportunities, seize them, turn on a dime. The other, though, is absorption. You know, think George Foreman circa 1974, just the ability to weather a punch. And, you know, for a corporation that could be through a lot of cash on the balance sheet, diversification, sheer size, you know, General Motors can't go bust, Citibank can't go bust, they're just too big to fail. And the companies that I suspect are going to come out of this the strongest are the ones that have some absorption but also have agility. So I think it's a useful framework for managers to think about what will allow us to get through this downturn. And for investors, it may be helpful in sort of thinking about which are the companies that are likely to come out on the other side creating more value.
Donald Saul is a professor at the London Business School. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Tess.
About 200,000 men and women leave the military every year. Many of them face the daunting task of finding work in the civilian world. Some have never written a resume or put on a suit. For members of the National Guard and Reserves, the threat of deployment may scare off potential employers. But some companies are going out of their way to hire military workers. Marketplace's Amy Scott visited one of them.
Tanya Arrowsmith was watching TV a few years ago when a news story caught her attention. It was about how veterans of the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq were having a hard time finding jobs when they got back home.
And I thought, how horrible is that? They're out serving our country and putting their life on the line for us, and we can't give them a job. It really bothered me.
Arrowsmith was in a position to do something about it. She's human resource director for manufacturer Atkins & Pierce in Covington, Kentucky. It's just outside Cincinnati. A few weeks after the news program, Arrowsmith saw an ad for a recruiter that places military workers in civilian jobs. She convinced her boss, Jeb Head, to sign up.
My conversation with Jeb was, look, I think, you know, we can get some really good people who have a solid work ethic because they've served our country. They know what it's like to work hard and to strive and to, you know, really struggle out there. He was all for it.
Today, Arrowsmith estimates more than 10% of employees are either ex-military or active servicemen and women. On the factory floor at Atkins and Pierce, giant spools of colored thread spin around on machines. The machines braid the threads together to make fishing line, candle wicks, even stove gaskets. Benny Gray runs machines that make motorcycle parts. He's also a specialist in the Army National Guard. He's spent more than 20 years in the military.
Afghanistan, Kosovo, Katrina. I served in the Cold War on the border in Germany. So I've had an interesting career.
Maintaining a civilian career hasn't been easy. It's against the law to discriminate against employees in the National Guard or Reserves. That doesn't mean it doesn't happen. As a guardsman, Gray has to spend a weekend every month in training and 2 weeks every summer. He can be deployed at any time.
I've lost one job because of it. I was told if I re-enlisted in the military, I would be let go. And even though I wasn't let go, my life was made so miserable that I did leave there.
At Atkins and Pierce, Gray says life is completely different.
They've been nothing but accommodating. If we need any time for military at all, we just get it. And I just got back from my two-week annual training, and when I got back, they was like, do you need a few days to rest up? Are you okay? But they're incredible people.
It helps that he's surrounded by other military people who understand his situation. Steve McCord found it tough to find a job when he left the Army 4 years ago. He spent 6 months looking for work. The family got by on his wife's paycheck and a lot of peanut butter and jelly sandwiches.
Infantry, you don't really learn too many trade skills, per se, other than, like, shooting. That doesn't really help you out in the civilian world too often.
McCord did have leadership skills. He's now a squad leader in the National Guard. He says that helped him move up quickly when he landed at Atkins and Pierce.
I mean, 2 years, and I'm already in charge of a shift here. And, you know, I do believe that it was that background and that training that got me to where I am.
Atkins and Pierce is willing to pay for leadership like that. It pays the recruiter about 13% of a military employee's starting salary. Tanya Arrowsmith says it's an investment.
To get right people, that's kind of one of those priceless commercials. A military background with a small fee, it's really priceless.
That commitment is about to be put to the test. Both Steve McCord and Benny Gray are scheduled to serve in Iraq soon. Arrowsmith says she's looking forward to seeing them back in their jobs when they return. In Covington, Kentucky, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
And join us this weekend on our personal finance program, Marketplace Money, for Debt of Service, a full hour of stories about money issues faced by members of the military, their families, and veterans.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering absolute return funds with goals designed to match yours. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
And this final note, in the Monopoly board game, when you're sent to jail, you go directly there. And just as in real life, you pay a fine to get out. It doesn't say anything about paying to get in. But that's exactly what new inmates may be expected to do in Philadelphia. The city prison system is mulling a $35 processing fee. The charge could raise more than $1 million for Philly's depleted coffers. Needless to say, inmates would also not pass go and would not collect $200. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow dropped 89 points, almost 1.2%. The Nasdaq fell 25 points, 1.7%. And the S&P lost 9 points, 1.2%. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Next time on the show, forget Tupperware and Mary Kay. Gold parties are where it's at.
So your total is 174.44.
Oh my God!
You can say goodbye.
I'm going to say goodbye.
See you later. Give me the check.
I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
all over the country.
We need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.